Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 190, Pharmacopoeia of Visualization, Tantra, Sex, and Meditation.
There's a great thing where once you get more aware of having a central channel, or you're programming yourself by visualizing it, and then you sort of imagine that your subtle consciousness goes up and goes into the center of those of like a central kind of little tower room, and then looks down the 32 lines, you know, to the openings of the things, and like smooths the nerve endings and feels the flow, their openness to flow, you know, and removes kinks and cranks by sort of looking around there. It just becomes a point of awareness. Or even goes out into the 32 petals and you sort of count them and so on. Then you go down in the throat, you have 16 that face upward, like a reverted umbrella, and you do the same. Then you go to the heart and you have the 8. And then the navel is 64, and you get where you really feel like you can feel that. It has a great, it's very wonderful, actually. You sort of work on learning to visualize that. It's really quite marvelous. Okay, so now Chakra Sambhara. Now within that, now the Guhya Samaja that we talked about is where you sort of learn about kind of like the setup. And then you get a very strong desire in that, by learning about that setup, to really do a visualization sadhana. Well, first you have to get an initiation from a responsible teacher, and then you learn to do a visualization sadhana. Because that visualization is where you develop a kind of ability in order to do that visualization sadhana. And the visualization sadhana is not just reciting or memorizing and then reciting, like, now you have so many hands and you're holding this and that hand, the other hand. That's what the sadhanas are. As texts, that's what they are. But and then now you melt down this way and now you rise again that way. It's like a whole performance, actually. But it's the visualization of it that's the main thing, not just the recitation. They make a big point out of that. And the purpose of that visualization is so that you can really imagine yourself having a different kind of a body and a nervous system. And if you think about it, at first you think, that's ridiculous, I can never really do that. But then, you know, meditate right now, for example. Just meditate now. Let's do that, for example. Let's meditate right now and visualize yourself as yourself. Let's try it. In other words, I'm sitting here, right? Now, I have a picture of myself as having 2 hands and 10 and 8 fingers and 2 thumbs and legs and toes, shoulders and skeleton and sense organs and my face and my skin and everything and my bones inside and, you know, nerves and bloodstream and heart beating, et cetera, et cetera. I have a whole picture of all of that. But actually, if I sit here now, I have to imagine my arm. I can wriggle my shoulder like this and feel like a sensation against my shirt on the skin. And maybe if I move the joint, you know, I can sort of get a sense of the bone, the upper arm bone, and then the elbow, I bump the elbow on something. But otherwise, what is your feeling of having these arms that are now folded in your lap because you're meditating? In a way, you're imagining them. aren't you? You're imagining I, Bob, have two arms that are the arms that I look, they look like what they looked like last time I looked at them. Right? Because I don't really feel like that. You know, you don't feel the whole arm. On the other hand, if someone amputated your arm, you would go around for a while still feeling the arm to the extent that you do, which means that you have an image in your brain of having this such and such an arm. So you're actually visualizing yourself all the time. So your imagination is routinized and tied up in maintaining whatever you think, you know, is the picture of yourself, your physical self, and your environment and everything, actually. So that's why for Tantra you have to have some understanding of emptiness / relativity, meaning that, you know, like a chair or a floor or the table or a pillar or the hand or something, any object is not just whatever our picture of it is. It's actually empty of being fixated by the picture that we have of it or the concept that we have of it. It's empty of that concept matching an essence in it, right? Which, you know, that's what emptiness means. It's a relate, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's a relational thing that's constantly changing, and it's inconceivable. Like, your hand is totally inconceivable. You know, even you look, it's different in different times, and it looks in different angles and a different thing, but then inside there's all these atoms, and inside the atoms are electrons and things, and wave-particle paradox is happening, and double-slot experiment is happening in every digit. And nobody knows what it is, and you don't either. But you're visualizing, so you're imagining it as fitting with your idea of your hand, and when you unimagine that, or you critically separate the reality of your hand from what you imagine, then your imagination becomes more free, and actually what you do is you become aware that you are imagining the thing rather than just thinking it's what's there, you know. And this gives you more sense of responsibility about how you imagine yourself and how you imagine even something that normally requires no comment because you assume it's what it always has seemed to be, right? So what Tantra is doing, that's why I say it's Buddhist neuroscience, it's going down into these areas where you have a phantom limb. In a way, you have a phantom body right now in your brain. And very possibly that phantom body, when you send a motor impulse, with which you don't realize you're sending, you just think, you just move your hand, you know? You don't realize you're sending an impulse. The brain is making a plan and telling muscles and nerves to do something and moving the hand, right? Because it happens so fast, you know? And, or even some of these experimental psychologists will say that we don't even do it, the brain does it or something. They have all these kind of statements. But it channels those, it's able to send those things because it has a map, a model in the mind of what your body is. And it sends them through that model. And that's probably why in sort of old ancient times, in different cultures, you know, they had Western, Eastern, and different kind, they had little homunculi idea theories, you know, that there was a little you inside you, you know. And that, but that homunculi made a way, it was your brain programming, in a way. It was your image. It was their kind of imagining or thinking that about the image that actually is in the brain of the ordinary person. So, sort of involuntarily there, you know. And so, the creation stage is where you recreate yourself in a body with certain attributes like limbs and colors and things that that somehow suit you, you're gravitate toward, or they have an impact in your nervous system's programming. And you get to where, and you wouldn't have enough imagination to do that if you weren't aware that, in a way, you didn't have a kind of measure of uncertainty about what it is you do, what you are, actually. You're sort of open to being something other than what you have assumed yourself to be, what you're programmed to be by your education, by your parents, by all sorts of things, much more than by some genes or something, actually. And so you have to have that loosening of your imprisonment in a world of concepts that you have been indoctrinated and educated into. Inducated into, maybe I should say. You know, that the world is this and that, and I am such and such. And reinforced, of course, by lots of things, but and we reinforce each other in our conceptualized roles and whatever it is. So that loosened by the emptiness thing, and it is considered unsafe to practice these more subtle things dealing with the nervous system until one is aware that whatever one is what one makes of oneself. And then, and one has to also, and one also has to have a degree of mental stability to be able to stay concentrated on one thing for some period of time, to sort of, and memorize something and then hold it in mind, you know, in detail, and then sort of feel it, you know. Like imagine even you had six arms, what would the shoulder joint feel like? What would the fingers feel like? And then they were holding certain things. And what would that feel like? And that's why this the Tibetan art, which is based on a huge Indian art, certainly, that has unfortunately all been destroyed. There's not hardly a single Indian cloth painting like a Tanka painting that they must have had millions of them in India. They're all totally destroyed in the second millennium. So we don't really have them. But we have the Tibetan ones are, you know, the offshoot of that. So they're more refined maybe in some respects, but they are that, you know. So the reason for having to do that, which Tom Yarnell's book is about, his translation of Tsongkhapa's 11th and 12th chapters of his Great Stages of the Mantric Path, is about the creation stage and why it's so necessary. And so every single thing that you do, like if you, any kind of one of those weird bodies that you might imagine yourself as having, if you successfully can visualize yourself as having such a body, shifting your brain model of yourself into that other model, then when you're in these subtle states, like dream-like states, or meditational dream-like states, meditationally developed dream state, you then can shape your energy body into an ideal vehicle for what you're trying to understand or what you're trying to experience. For your, you know, to courageously and be unafraid of melting, for example, and able to experience internally in the petals of these inner chakras bliss that normally we only taste a tiny fragment of in the orgasm experience, usually. Occasionally some other kind of experience in some other part of the nervous system, but usually it's all genitally organized in the ordinary person. And so, you know, there's this whole thing about tantric sex, and the Chakrasambhara, the mother tantras particularly, have led to a lot of confusion about it, and actually not just Westerners. Some Tibetans have abused the whole thing about how sexuality is part of it, to go and jump on a bunch of girls here and there in a most disgraceful manner. And they get in trouble about it, as they should. The Dalai Lama advised people, and they hide behind, they say, a crazy wisdom, I'm a psychonaut and I can do this. And meanwhile, they're grossly overweight and they ride around in BMWs and they're not living in a burning ground with a loincloth and long weird hair and eating like strange food and really being yogis and dying a million times a night every night. They're not true psychonauts. They're making like Dharma empires, organizations and things like that. And it's a disgrace. And they're not only Tibetans, and there's Zen people who do it. There's Swamis who do it. And it's wrong, completely wrong. And what these people are, they're taking these forms and they're thinking it's just something that ordinary people do. But this is not an excuse to go and behave in some ordinary way. And by the way, ancient India, it's not Tibetan's fault either, it's Indian's fault. This all comes from India. And ancient India didn't have to have a tantric excuse to have an orgy. They have the Kama Sutra. Do you know what I mean? They know how to party. They were partying thousands of years before Masters and Johnson or whatever. You know, I always jokingly like to say that the Indian Masters and Johnson occurred in the second century of the Common Era. They weren't so freaked out as the Europeans, you know, or even the Chinese, you know. This is this kind of deep, unconscious, erotic energy, but not any kind of ordinary sexuality at all. Not at all. It's some kind of really strange yoga. It's an athletic thing, you know. And by the way, both parties have to be at the same level or it can't work out. That makes it really difficult. In other words, a lot of the scholars who like to sneer about the Tantra, in my colleagues, you know, and they write all kinds of things, and they think these psychonauts are people who want to go and like slurp on strange juices. They do. They think that's the main thing. Oh, they want that they're going to get immoral by going and eating some semen or some menstrual blood or whatever. They go. They're just nuts. To be so rude to these great yogis, you know, they're not at all interested in such things. That's ridiculous. What it is they are trying to open these chakras. The 64 petals, it's at the navel. It isn't even where the genitalia are. It's at the navel. Now try to have an orgasm in that chakra, meaning let those nerves completely open and completely melt and generate bliss, you know. That's what they're talking about. The ultimate one is, in Hindu tantra, they tend to think the ultimate one is the brain chakra. They're all into blowing the brain thing because they want to become gods, you know. But Shiva, you know, they want to become Shiva. But in the Buddhist thing, there can be a big bliss in the brain, yes. And in the throat, too. But the big one is the heart. The heart chakra is the most important. Although it's piddling 8 petals, but apparently that's enough. Because somehow it's not only 8, actually. It's each of the 8 is branches into 3. So there's actually 24. And they're red, white, and blue again. Like the 3 channels, it's a far out thing. The heart chakra, chakra sambhara, especially about the heart chakra. It's and Guhya Samaja both are. So that's why Tsongkhapa rejected the idea that Guhya Samaja father and others are father tantras, and chakra sambhara is the mother tantra. You know, clear light emphasis, in other words. And father tantra, magic body emphasis, because the union or communion, as I translated, of the highest level of the 5 perfection stages in the tantra is the union of the magic body and clear light, male and female, bliss and void, and so on. And then the Kalachakra is the non-dual tantra, neither father nor mother, but non-dual. But he rejected that. He said all of the unexcelled yoga tantras are non-dual. And it's just the emphasis in the Guhya Samaja, emphasis in the Chakra Sambhara, but they're really the same. He Vajra, Hayagriva, etc., all of them, Yamanteka, they're all the same. But they're different emphases for people who are different aptitudes and inclinations, just like any other thing, like, you know, for like a pharmacopoeia of visualization, you could say, of neurology, of neuroscience. And Kala Chakra is in the Mother Tantra side because it so much develops the inner chakras. And it actually, the Kala Chakra has a unique thing where it doesn't use a magic body. It sort of transmutes the body in place, the coarse body. So it's something completely different, which we'll talk about more next time. It has a different thing, and it's very interconnected also with the Shaivites because of its history, you know, to appeal to them, and really it has all the Hindu gods in it, 722 deities. It's really quite a menagerie in the Kala Chakra. So it doesn't really. It's not that this or that syllable is the only thing that you can do.
Oh, okay.
What it is that if you can hold your mind stably at some point within the nerve, if you develop a map of your own subtle nervous system, not super subtle, it's not a nervous system, but the subtle nervous system, if you develop a map of it that somehow fits into your own physiology, and then you put your mind in a point in that map, putting the mind there will have will move energy to it. You know, visualizing it moves energy to that point. Like our beloved Bill Bushell, you know, the archivist of all the articles. People have done experiments in labs in University of Ohio State and different weird things. Like if someone puts their mind and holds it on a point on their palm, they then measure a temperature differential by holding their mind. So there's been some sort of certain people who are not like fanatic materialists have actually been testing these things out. So that's really what it is, you know, the letters and the different things. But there's some auspiciousness about Om Ahum, you know, in the brain, throat, and heart, for example. Swaha, you know, for example, if you do all five in the Om Ahum Swaha, you know, there's another way to do it. Or Ha Ho Ri, there's other things in Tantra, in Kalachakra, they have other syllables. So it's not like the one syllable has to just be like this and it can only look like that and the other. There are just different things that are developed that have auspiciousness that people have used before. And there is a short ah thing that it bursts into flame in Dumo, which comes from that letter ah. You know, like a little thing like that in Tibetan, like that. And then they just simplify it into just what looks like an exclamation point. You know, it's a sort of simple thing because it's meant to burst into flame. Because the real Dumo is supposed to be just an inner flame inside the central channel, not heating your whole body, actually. When you do a thing, you can just hold your breath and heat your body. I don't know do you ever have a mountaineer do that? If you're wearing a wool sweater or even a cotton t-shirt, and someone comes and blows on your back, it can almost be so hot it stings. You know, there's a lot of heat in the body, you know. So Dumo is not just about making the body hot, although it was a good byproduct that Milarepa could live in the hills, in the Kailash in the winter, you know, naked. But that was a byproduct. But the main thing is to have a fire, a flame like it's like natural gas, you know. It's not a coal flame, it's natural gas. And it goes up the central channel, melts, it's meant to melt the neurotransmitters, you know, in the brain, you know, and to make them flow in the system. Then, you know, in this area, this advanced area where the psychonauts are, there are actually angels who get involved and who show up, who are not normally human. And, you know, one goes on long retreats and they show up and they teach people, they do things, and they punish people who behave badly, actually. And they guard the secrecy of things. They are such beings. Dakinis, you know, Jung's anima, you know, Carl Jung's anima, but it's not just a mental fantasy. It's really, they really do exist. And they're female, they're enlightened beings. There are also worldly Dakinis who one has to be a little cautious about, you know, but there are these extraordinary ones, definitely. I can swear to it. The subtle mind are these three void states, seeming voids, like vast states. Moonlit, sunlit, and darklit. That's the subtle mind. The super subtle mind itself. So it's bliss realizing voidness, which is at first seems like an odd thing. How can bliss know voidness? How can bliss be a subjectivity that knows voidness? In a way, you know. So bliss, bliss knows voidness means, I think, that bliss sort of melts one away from structures. You know, bliss melts you. And then that bliss, knowing voidness, then is able to completely melt. And so there's a bliss voidness experience of sleep. There's a bliss void experience of death. There's a bliss void experience of orgasm. These are the deepest, you know, the ordinary, in ordinary life, those are the normal deep ones. And the blissful void thing of Yuganada then is one that is control all of those, you know. And dying is inconvenient, you know. Then you have to be reborn. So that's where to take the bliss of ordinary orgasm, which is so partial compared to the whole nervous system, rather than just what Freud called genitally organized, or Wilhelm Reich also called genitally organized. It's so small compared to but it's a metaphor almost, so it's an analogy. It's a gateway for the larger one, which is the whole system. And Which is why ordinary, some fake guru who grabs some female and rushes off and says, now we're going to have a big initiation or something, or you're going to serve and attain enlightenment, or, is total BS, because both people have to have the open nervous system where they, it's in the head and the heart and the throat. It's not just some pumping stuff, you know. Might be part of it, but that's not it. And also the whole, you know, the, what they call seminal retention. But not seminal retention by clamping off sensation, but seminal retention, totally melting, letting it all go, and yet not emitting anything. Try it. try that. One of those lamas, what they're doing, you know. They're not able to do that. So it's all BS if someone can't do that. Then they're not supposed to, it's just regular sex, and it's an excuse for it, and it's fake. But if they have the ability, then it is. Then sometimes there are things where there is, you know, a couple is involved. But both have to know about it, what it is. And both have to have all the prerequisites, the certain level of detachment, not to go nuts, the compassion thing, not to sort of veer off onto power trips, and the wisdom thing, you know. To be aware of that voidness that they're experiencing, that their bliss is melting into, which is infinite, you know, not some specific organized biological function, if you follow me.
Greetings and salutations, podcast Wallas. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This episode was originally recorded as a part of the Force for Good class series, an ongoing annual class happening now online and in person from Tibet House, U.S. in New York City. Join Bob this December 17th in New York City as he continues this class in person. Attendance at past sessions is not required, and access to past classes are provided for those joining via live stream. Tibet House members have access to the complete recordings as a part of the Tibet House US membership archives. For those of you not yet members of the Tibet House US Menla community, selections from this annual dynamic series inspired by the work of Daniel Goleman and His Holiness the Dalai Lama can be enjoyed for free as a part of the Tibet House US Menla YouTube channel and in past episodes of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This episode is a continuation from last week's episode, so if you're feeling a little lost, I do encourage you to backtrack a little bit and check out last week's teaching, which might provide a ground for some of the topics mentioned here. And if you're still lost by the end of this teaching, stay tuned. We'll be posting the full audio archive, which is a combination of last week's episode, this week's episode, plus additional content we couldn't fit into these two episodes. If you're curious about engaging some of the practices Professor Thurman mentions in this week's episode, be sure to check out the podcast description. We'll link to other episodes and videos where Professor Thurman and other Tibet House teachers provide the basic instructions and backgrounds for these meditations. As Bob mentioned in the first half of this episode and in many, many, many other instances, these video and audio teachings are meant for a general audience and for those looking to learn more about the practices, and are not intended to replace a qualified teacher. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, please visit tibethouse.us. Your monthly contributions help support the ongoing mission to present and preserve Tibetan culture. As a part of this week's poetry segment by Gary Gok, he'll be reading one of my favorite poets of all time and a personal friend and mentor to me, W.S. Merwin. I've had the distinct honor of visiting W.S. Merwin's palm forest on Maui, and he gave the commencement speech at my high school graduation. At the time, I had no idea who he was, but as I've learned more about him and got to know him over the years, he's been a deep source of inspiration, and a lot of my life has been modeled after things I've learned from his poetry and his personal life journey. To learn more about W.S. Merwin, please visit the links in the podcast description. And now, back to Bob and Gary's reading of W.S. Merwin.
So what's so beautiful is the madhyama, the word madhyamaka, and the middle way, you know, central. I prefer central because it's central channel. But finally, that's the only way one fully can understand emptiness, which is why one doesn't really understand emptiness. One just melts into it, and there's no possession of that experience actually. One has to just give oneself to that experience completely. And therefore, someone who says, I realize it, I know it, it's a nonsense. In a way, okay, well, they had some experience, but they don't own that experience. It owns them, actually. And the voidness owns you only when you're owned by voidness. All you can do is be compassionate and non-harmful to anybody. You're not the reason that Manjushri overwhelms Yama, you know. They had these, you know, god battles, you know, like the famous Yamantaka thing. The reason that he does is because he is not opposing Yama. He is one with Yama. And so to teach Yama not to be separate, he can reflect a million Yamas to Yama, if you follow me. So Yama is confronted by like infinite Yamas, and then he doesn't go around killing people anymore, you know. Yama is the Indian god of death, right? But he doesn't do it because he's somehow bigger than Yama. He is, the only way you can be bigger than some deity like that is to also be the deity. And therefore there's no opposition. The deity melts right into you, you know. And then realizes, oh wow, that's different. Emptiness is like that. That's why they say, beginning of Tsongkhapa's book, he says, Shambhu Megavahana Hiranyagarbha Damodara and Anangapati. When they see you, they melt like fireflies in the sun. Remember that? You know, from the Buddhist point of view, the unenlightened person is insane. You know, enlightenment is not madness, it's sanity. But as Milarepa said, sometimes people who live by the Dharma, they are thought of as mad by the ordinary people, whereas they think that ordinary people are mad. Because the ordinary people are just going from birth to death without like seeing to their final destiny and without like using their precious human life to save themselves from all kinds of future laws of suffering and so on. So they're doing things that they, in order to be happy, they're doing things that are going to make them miserable, so they seem insane to a Dharma person. Milarepa said that. I don't remember what our previous conversation was. And I have said, and we do have to imagine what Buddhahood is, not just Kalachakra, but Buddhahood. You know, Kalachakra, Chakrasambhara, these are just tools to accelerate a vast evolution to Buddhahood, physical as well as mental, into a smaller time frame, you know, by compressing time by entering a subtle plane, something like that. That's what Tantra really is. And it's because I was saying that, it's like at the beginning, it's like a bodhisattva is happy to spend infinite lifetimes becoming a Buddha. But once they get to where they can taste it a little bit, they're not happy to have other beings, their other mother beings, other beings who they think are their mothers, to wait for them to be able to be skillful enough to really help them maximally. And, you know, they can sort of rationalize and sit back. The Tsongkhapa says in the Ngarim Chemo, this sort of old salt type thing. It's like, oh, well, the other Buddhas are really working on it. Why should I work myself up? You know, there's lots of Buddhas, so they're all working on everybody, so everything will be fine. I don't have to really sweat it. But the Bodhisattva, when they reach a certain point, they get, well, the other Buddhas may be working, but they seem to have, they haven't really reached Trump Tower yet, quite. They're not really like on the 53rd floor of Trump Tower, like telling those people to like get out there and noblesse oblige, you know. And so I'm going to be one of them. I'm going to see to it that the people that I see that I don't think are being helped enough are getting helped. And I'm going to accelerate my ability to do that. And then it's like in a dream. You know, you could have a dream, and technically, you could have a lucid dream where you could die 10 times in a night in a situation where the death process was where you had to give your life to somebody. You could do that in a dream and then wake up and you wouldn't have to be reborn and go back to school and high school and college and meet Buddhism and be a Bodhisattva vow and whatever. You could gain the what they call the merit of giving your life or giving something precious to you in a dream 10 times, 20 times over, and it would, because it was a dream. In a way, you would be able to do that without having to go through the whole physiological, biological process of dying and being reborn. So then you think of 1,000 times in a night, 1,000,000 times in a day or in a week, in a month, in a year, you know, and you're really changing your whole relationship to the universe, you follow me. Now, you mentioned Big Bang. The Big Bang is kind of a, I think, pretty much our militarized Western society fantasy that there was some sort of Big Bang, you know. I think that in the Sanskrit universe, Hindu as well as Buddhist, even Vedist, in between, in times of what they call pralaya, when the universe has dissolved, what's lying around are not atoms or subatomic energies or some sort of pent-up black hole things that are going to explode sometime. What is lying around are consonants and vowels that do not come together. They're disaggregated, and especially the vowels are missing. So the consonants are all lying around, and they cannot express anything. And there's, and you know, they have this thing that language creates the world. You know, in the beginning was the word. Well, these are the components of words, but they can't function. So what happens is the sound comes, which is the Brahma sound, and it picks up all these consonants and starts making language and then mantra, and then things are created. And so it's a little smoother, you know, it's like turning up the volume in an audio, and then becomes video rather than a big explosion, you know. You know, which is kind of a militaristic society's fantasy of what God is there, is the big exploder. The Indians had that too. The Vajra, you know that they call the Vajra? The Vajra was Indra's scepter that emanated thunderbolts, and he could split cities, and he could split dragons with it, you know. It was a weapon. It was the supreme weapon, Indra's weapon, the Vajra. And then it became for the Buddhists, and then the Buddhists sort of made the Hindus see it like that a little bit. That it's like love is what it is. The stronger force is love, not anger, ferocity, explosiveness, you know. That's the Mantabhadra thing. I hope you went and got that book and read those things now and then, because that's the Mantabhadra is in every atom. There's Buddha lands and universes in every atom of this one. In every subatomic particle, there's infinite numbers of them. And we are just one in some infinite particle. So it's like, it's a wonderful vision, that is. It's really wonderful. Even just a little bit swimming in it, bathing in it. You know, putting it on at night, reading a paragraph, like putting on night cream or something, you know. Then you can go to sleep and feel happy. But also, actually, in Indian culture today, people are scared of tantrics. You know, and it's like, oh, tantra, no, no. And that's something weird. Because there's also been so much abuse. Like these lamas who have abused their students, you know. Well, we're going to let's go have some tantric sex. That's just BS. So sexual energy is very, very precious and valuable, but it is the matter of going off and it's not an excuse for rolling in the hay. People don't need an excuse for that. They do that anyway. You know, I think so. We have a population problem. As far as experiments go, you know, I think KGB and CIA are likely to make psychonaut experiments, but I think they didn't get too far, you know, because they kept, in the old days, they were all doing psychedelic experiments. And then they were trying to give soldiers like different psychedelic drugs, thinking they could become super killers. And then the soldiers just all lay down like, wow, and started laughing, you know. And they were embracing the enemy, you know, and that happened. So that didn't work out. So they gave up on that. And then they do give them amphetamine and stuff like that to make them like nervous, you know. So, you know, they don't believe in these things, you know. So they don't experiment about it, you know. And it's not really necessary to do that kind of experiment. But I think Davidson and his group, the neuroscientists, will eventually get interested in the subtle nervous system. And instead of just meditating someone thinking compassion, which is itself very valuable, but still it's just a beginning thing, they will do different kinds of meditation and really get people working on that and measure what happens in the nervous system with that. I think that'll be useful. But of course, the most useful thing will be if the scientists themselves do these meditations and it becomes part of scientific training, where you learn to, you know, like emptiness meditation, if you do, and then, you know, this whole thing where they're so freaked out about quantum and you know, the string theory and 11 dimensions and, you know, keep following the holes in the theories of the standard, quote-unquote, standard model, and by trying to patch the holes by going into all these sort of sci-fi ideas that they can't really experiment about, which are really unscientific. They're really theological, practically. So if they did more emptiness meditation, I think they'd be more successful in doing that, actually. They'd use their math more. And eventually, I think it should be the training for a physicist or a biologist. Should be that sort of thing. I really do. But I thought it would happen in my lifetime when I was a young professor, young scholar. But the resistance is so huge, too much. You know, they're being stuck to the idea that we're so smart and we're the most advanced civilization that ever happened. And it's really big. I mean, it's all these campuses, you know, they're so triumphalist about it. It's incredible. Meanwhile, the evidence is that they're wrecking the entire planet in a speedily. And it's producing more people to do so. But the Theravada tradition is, in a way, Buddha taught for people who would be confused by things like non-dualism and would become discouraged about it. So it's like different things for different people who have different intellectual, mental, emotional abilities. There's a ladder for everyone. There's a rung on the ladder that everyone can get on. And Theravada, unfortunately, is for the people who, I mean, fortunately, I should say, is for people who cannot conceive that the world is nirvana and that they have to proceed by removing their own ignorance about that nirvana. They are so sensitive about the world, and in some other way, they are so narcissistic about their inner self that they suffer in the world. And yet they feel somehow in there's some grand place that's really marvelous. So he urges them to feel that nirvana will be somewhere else, and it will be apart from this that's causing the suffering. But what happens is that then they withdraw into this inner space, and then they discover that, and they're capable of dismissing this existence of all this, and they think that's a nirvana. But then they keep coming back here, and then they're feeling less and less intent about escaping. So then they're willing to tackle the situation, if you follow me. It's like the Buddha said, there are several analogies he gave in the Lotus Sutra to Shariputra, who said, well, why didn't you tell us that it's all fine to start with and we're already in nirvana and it's non-dual and all this? And he said, well, there's a captain, a caravan driver who's leading a whole caravan across a desert, and they're getting very near the end of their supplies, and the people in the caravan, he becomes aware, they're plotting to assassinate him and turn back because they think he's lost. And then, but they can never make it back to where they came from. They're already 4 weeks into the thing, and they only have a few more days. And actually, he knows that the oasis is just a few more days. He knows that, because he's not lost. But they're not believing him, and they're rebelling, and they're not moving. So he says, this caravan guy apparently has some sort of hypnotic or magician powers. So he creates a false oasis, one further day away that they can see. And then they see that, oh, great, and they run to the false oasis. But then when they get to the false oasis, he creates a vision for them. When they get to the false oasis, then, oh, there's no oasis here. There was a hallucination. And then they would really kill him. But he spaces it out where, from that, they can see the real one. So then he says, oh, no, you don't have, look, there it is. It really is there, you know. And then they make it to the real one. So that's one of his analogies. And he has another great one where a doctor has some kind of medicines that are poisonous in his, you know, pharmacopoeia, but, you know, in tiny doses, they're helpful for certain conditions. And he has these children who are very naughty, and they break into his medicine cabinet when he's away on a trip, and they steal the medicines, and they eat them, and they get poisoned, and they become paranoid. And so when he comes back, he can't give them the antidote. He doesn't know how to do it because they're frightened of him and so on. So then what he does is he puts the antidote back in the cabinet and he locks it up and then he goes away again. They go and steal it again and then they cure themselves, you know. So he has, there are lots of images. Then there's another great one about the mother. There's a mother whose infant has some strange disease. And the doctor comes and says, I can cure the infant, but it's very crucial that you don't give any breast milk for 2 weeks while this medicine works its thing, just water. And then she says, but my breasts are overflowing, and he cries, and I can't stand it, and he wants only the milk. What can I do? And he says, okay, I'll tell you. And he gives her a paste. And the paste is a vile-smelling, vile-tasting thing to put on her nipples. He says, okay, when the baby cries, just give it the nipple with this foul-smelling paste. And, of course, the foul-smelling is suffering, you know, impermanence, you know, death, misery, whatever, you know, all the descriptions of suffering in the Theravada. And so then the baby will go like this and won't want to drink. So then you can be cool, you know. If your breast hurt, you can express it and throw it away or save it. So then the baby is healed, and then she nurses it again. So he's saying that his teaching of the Mahayana is like mother's milk, of the Buddha's mother's milk. But some people can't digest it, and it'll poison them because they'll think, well, if it's all nirvana and I'm still suffering, then who needs nirvana? Forget it. This guy's an idiot. Or if it's all nirvana, I can do whatever I feel like, and I can do even evil things. It won't matter because it's all nirvana. So someone will misunderstand the thing in that way. So for them, the Theravada. And I think particularly the Theravada target were mostly Brahmin males who were mostly into themselves. They were maybe a little narcissistic, let's say. Their mothers spoiled them a lot, or their fathers would beat them up, beat the mothers up if they didn't. And in that way the family system was. And so they couldn't think of being blissfully enlightened, sitting around with all the untouchables and the non-twice-born people. And so they had to think there was some vast place waiting for them, the elite, that they would reach that was separate. You know. And then when they got there, what they were separated from was their narcissism, and then they were ready for the long evolution of the Mahayana, you know, bodhisattva path, my opinion. You know. But on the other hand, I have a theory that actually nobody else agrees with me. Good night. Nobody else agrees with my theory. If you have studied more Buddhism, you know there's something called the four formless realms. And the Buddha specifically says those realms are not nirvana. But one of them is infinite space, infinite consciousness, absolute nothingness, and beyond consciousness and unconsciousness is the fourth one. And in a way, that's Turiya for most of the Hindus who think that the ultimate is they still think that Nirvikalpa Samadhi, just disappearing from everything, is the ultimate. You know, they still act like that. Because that's a natural escapist attitude that we have. But those four, if you align them with the three levels of the subtle body, you know, the three luminances, and then the fourth is the clear light. They are kind of hinted teachings of that, you know. But the idea is that you don't stay in those things. Those are just layers of your body. You become conscious of them, of your unconscious. The three luminances, by the way, also have 80 instinctual surges in them that the normal person, therefore, doesn't really see vast space of moonlight and sunlight and so forth, because they have different kinds of, like, surge, you know, instinctual surges. They want to grab something or do something, and so they don't notice they're in a vast space. They want to be defined as separate from things, so that they have these instinctual surges. And it's only the more, when you become more and more conscious of your unconscious, or you're not victim of your instincts, you then see them as these spaces, you know. But those meditators reached something like those places in themselves, which are the formless realms. But then if they stick there, they become reborn as formless realm deities, which is a way station where they're stuck there, you see. He's teaching the subtle sort of cosmology of the tantras, actually, already in the Theravada. It's all there, you know. But, you know, as he said to them, he said, I have held nothing back from you. He says that in Theravada's Pali. I have not held anything back, you know. I have not had the closed fist of a bad teacher, he said. But on the other hand, what I've been able to share with you is like this fistful of leaves, and really the Dharma, my teachings are like this vast forest with all the leaves in the forest, he says. Buddha in the Theravada says. So there's all this stuff in the Theravada pointing to non-duality, pointing to that nirvana is not simply an escape and a disappearance, pointing to the compassion. Even he teaches all his former lives, 500, 5,000 former lives as bodhisattvas himself. But he just doesn't say to them, you have to do like that. You have to feed your body to the tiger. You have to be a woman. You have to be an animal. You have to do all this stuff. He doesn't say that, which Mahayana kind of bodhisattva thing says, yes, that's you all have to be bodhisattvas, you know. But he says, I was a bodhisattva, right? And says, I did all those things. So therefore, I'm a Buddha now. You guys are just arhats. But that's enough for you at the moment. Okay, cool. But hey, and then later, and there are some debates in India where the people who are saying, well, no, that's wrong, you know. Buddha doesn't have a body. Buddha disappeared into final nirvana. He's just left, you know. And that's what we're doing. We're leaving. And this nonsense that the Buddha has Dharmakaya, and Dharmakaya just means the books, the teaching, and that he has a Sambhogakaya, and he manifests and emanates, and that's ridiculous. And then you ask them, then the debates, they say, well, how come Buddha is able to do all that teaching and stuff, and you guys can't do that? And they say, oh, he's luckier. He's lucky. He was lucky, they say. But they have no explanation for that. And they don't say, oh, bodhisattva, 500 bodhisattva lives, 1,000 bodhisattva lives, we're all going to do that. They don't say that. They don't want to face that. Okay? All right. I think that's it.
Reading a poem by W.S. Merwin, who turned 91 last month. He lives now in Hawaii, in a community where he has planted more trees than probably had ever grown there indigenously. I first met him when I was a young man and was very inspired by his presence as a literary translator and a poet, working very much on his own, to his own drum, marching to his own music, and a considerable conscience in the life of the times, and a poet whose work evolved from kind of a mythological background into a wonderful voice speaking out of the present moment, as we can hear in this example. Thanks. Listen. With the night falling, we are saying thank you. We are stopping on the bridges to bow from the railings. We are running out of the glass rooms with our mouths full of food to look at the sky and say thank you. We are standing by the water, thanking it. Standing by the windows, looking out in our directions. Back from a series of hospitals, back from a mugging, after funerals, we are saying thank you. After the news of the dead, whether or not we knew them, we are saying thank you. Over telephones, we are saying thank you. In doorways and in the backs of cars and in elevators, remembering wars and the police at the door and the beatings on stairs, we are saying thank you. In the banks, we are saying thank you. In the faces of the officials and the rich, and of all who will never change, we go on saying thank you, thank you. With the animals dying around us, taking our feelings, we are saying thank you. With the forests falling faster than the minutes of our lives, we are saying thank you. With the words going out like cells of a brain, with the cities growing over us, we are saying thank you faster and faster. With nobody listening, we are saying thank you. Thank you, we are saying and waving, dark though it is. I'm Gary Gock, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman Podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal. Thank you.